You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 13th of September 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
Florida is as well prepared as you can be for something like this. We're with everybody in Florida. We're working very hard. We have tremendous talent and really tremendously brave people to be there. And hopefully it's going to work out all right.
America's president gives a pep talk before Irma hit Florida as he prepares to visit the state to survey the destruction it left behind. My guests Somnath Batabayal and Michael Goldfarb will discuss that and the day's other top stories, including a gathering clamor in South Korea for a nuclear program to match the North's, a new friend-winning and people-influencing initiative by Saudi Arabia, and the vote by the Filipino Congress to not merely injure the country's Human Rights Commission, but insult it as well. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Michael Goldfarb, the author and broadcaster, and Somnath Batabayal, lecturer in media in development and international journalism at SOAS. Welcome both. We will start in Florida, visited earlier this week by a capricious force of nature which bulldozed everything in its path and left a trail of destruction and bewilderment, and is tomorrow hosting a visit by President Donald Trump. The previous week's deluging of Texas offered Trump some practice. The phrase dry run seems inappropriate in the circumstances, but he has not always seemed altogether at ease with the empathy dispensing aspect of his present job. Michael, first of all, is it possible he might have some more instinctive feeling for this one, being as he is a semi-resident of Florida?
Especially since he took over the White House, because he seems to be in Mar-a-Lago at least one weekend a month when he's not up in Bedminster, New Jersey, at his other golf course on the weekend. No, it's interesting. Yes, he's interested because he went to Mar-a-Lago, but I think that the deeper point here is that this sequence of natural disasters proves that, for better or worse, George W. Bush is the most influential president so far in the 21st century, because everybody's trying not to be like him. George W. Bush so messed up the response to Hurricane Katrina in 2005 that both Barack Obama and now Donald Trump are anxious to be on scene as fast as possible. The empathy machine, the other way in which Bush is influential, is he's so messed up the invasion, overthrow of Saddam, and then the occupation, that neither Barack Obama nor Donald Trump ever wants to send real numbers of American troops into harm's way again. He's a very influential guy, George W.
Eight-year masterclass in how not to be president.
My God. And then
at home and abroad.
And then they end up, the Americans end up sending Donald Trump there anyway. So, he's got to do the thing about this particular trip is that, you can't fast forward reality. And throughout the day, we've been finally learning more and more about the devastation of this hurricane. It wasn't as earth-shattering initially as Harvey 3 weeks ago in Houston. But today we learned that, five elderly people were trapped in an old age home in Florida and they died. They couldn't get out. And I think that the scale of the destruction from the Keys up into, Miami and then on up towards St. Petersburg has yet to be fully revealed.
Somnath, what actually should be a president or head of state's role at a moment like this? We also see France's president, Emmanuel Macron, turning up on St. Martin or what remains of it. Does it actually help?
Well, in a sense, the gravity of the situation needs a presidential response. Coming of Donald Trump means that it's taken seriously. But we've been sending, oddly colored haired men from UK. So you never know with this. But there's one aspect of this response to Trump, the storm, the devastation itself, which I wanted to highlight. And we have been seeing a lot of comments from people, the climate change activists and scientists, and the immediate reaction. Donald Trump, America, is known as climate change deniers, skeptics at best. Suddenly, we have been talking about, look, this is what happens when you do not acknowledge climate change. And I'm worried, and others, you know, other activists are worried that an immediate connection to climate change and catastrophes like this means that we do not really seriously think through what, you know, catastrophes have happened before yeah. industrial revolution. But,
and this is the standard so, response so from the deniers.
Easy lose reaction. So, which I'm slightly worried about, because you equate Donald Trump, climate change denying, and catastrophes like this very quickly together.
But just to further that, though, on the role, Somnath, of the head of state, if this had happened to your home, your neighbourhood, your town, would you be personally comforted at all as you sort of stood knee-deep in water, you know, near what was once your house, whether the president bothered to turn up and shake your hand or not? Or would you rather he was back in the capital coordinating an efficient response?
Well, you know, our prime minister, like Narendra Modi and Manmohan Singh, they always do this helicopter trips, which are the favourites, and we see lots of aerial photographs. In a sense, no, because it takes a huge amount of security, money and distraction of forces and people who are employed in saving people's lives towards the head of the state. You're absolutely right in that. But as Michael just said, his not coming would in somehow bring back that nonchalance which President Bush reacted with.
Because the irony being, of course, that this was always Bush's rationale, that he knew that if he personally turned up in New Orleans, that, you know, this becomes a total circus, because every time the U.S. president moves anywhere, it's a total circus.
Yeah, but unfortunately for him, the optics were really poor.
It was a horrible photograph from that point of view of him looking out of Air Force One from...
No, I'm talking about the other one. He finally landed on the ground, and he went to the cathedral, I forget which saint it's named for, Cathedral Square, which is one of the tourist heart of New Orleans, and everybody had been kept away. I mean, a lot of people had fled anyway. And it's just him delivering a speech. There's no one there. You think, well, who are you comforting, Jack? You know, and it didn't quite work. And it didn't work, frankly, with Harvey a couple of weeks ago for Trump. I was on vacation in America, and I remember the one news report I did watch was like, after he flew in, and, you know, he didn't really go down to meet the people.
That was on the first visit.
Yeah, he went back for a second visit because he read all the tweets and he said, oh my God. And then he fired three staffers who failed to explain to him why he should actually meet a real human being. You know, the question you put to someone is the right one. I mean, if you've lost everything, the arrival of your prime minister or president actually doesn't mean a damn thing, but it is more to say, I think, you know, the government hasn't forgotten you, because I don't know why it is, and this has nothing to do with climate change, but these kinds of disasters tend to happen in areas that frequently, at least in India, people yeah. don't really care about. You know, they come up the Bay of Bengal too often, and people who, you know... I don't know.
But Florida and Bay of Bengal? I mean, would it be equated in the same way?
I don't know. I mean, well, I'm just saying that frequently they happen in areas where people are saying, well, we know they're low-lying. We know they get yeah. storms. Who cares? And it's a way of saying from the central government, you know, look, we do know you're here and we will do what we can. Then, of course, in America, the Republican Congress says, well, you can't give them any more money because we have no money. We can't go any deeper in debt. And then they have to figure it out.
But to be fair to Trump, though, on this, that he has said that money doesn't matter. His tweets, and I'm also one, that, you know, we will put... I mean, so what I'm trying to say, perhaps we might say that symbolic gestures...
They have a meaning.
You cannot completely... If he hadn't turned up, then we'd have said, hey, look,
well,
he's
exactly.
going to show up.
I mean, genuine question, though, Michael. I don't know if the American media that you were following while you were there has lost interest in this or not. Do we know if he's actually written that check for $1 million as his own money to victims of Hurricane Harvey?
Oh, they lost interest after about 72 hours. Every every hour on the hour, some major American correspondent who's in the White House press corps was tweeting, haven't seen a check yet, no checks. And I think people sort of understand that we're not going to ever see that check, really. But he'll tell you he wrote it because he just says stuff.
Okay. Well, let's look now at South Korea, a country which, in theory, already has a nuclear deterrent, i.e. that of the United States, which is treaty-bound to South Korea's defence in the event of external aggression. However, a combination of North Korea's increasing belligerence and the United States' decreasing reliability under Donald Trump is causing increasing numbers of South Koreans to wonder whether the moment might have arrived to take care of themselves. Polls now suggest that 60% of South Koreans support the establishment of a native nuclear weapons program. Somnath, from South Korea's point of view, you can kind of see where they're coming from. Is this a reasonable ambition on their part?
That's a big question.
I mean, that's what we're here for.
The deterrence theory when it comes to nuclear weapons, in a sense, in a very perverted sense, works, because the argument can be that no nuclear armed countries have gone to full-scale war, and this including India and Pakistan, which fought a kind of contained war in 2001.
Yes.
So in that sense, that nuclear deterrence theory can be said to be valid. The problem is that the counter argument should be that a very short time has elapsed. It's not been very long, you know, it's just about quarter of a century. 50 years when, you know, we've started getting into this thing. So while I see both sides of the argument, the moment India tested a nuclear weapon, immediately Pakistan had to. So the argument from the North Korea side, and governments have to cater to populist demands. I see where it's coming from. Whether it's necessary, I don't know. It's a more tactical question. It's a more question for their military to think through. And whether North Korea will ever really think of employing those warheads.
Would North Korea be more deterred than North Korea already is by a South Korean nuclear deterrent? I mean, the North Koreans presumably do understand that any first use of their nuclear weapons would be the last thing they ever did.
I don't think there's any doubt about it. And I think that... that's one of the reasons why, for all of this rhetorical yelling and screaming and all the interest that we've had in the last, I don't know, 3 or 4 months about it, that it still seems incredibly unlikely. And what's interesting is this, we're talking about this because of an analysis piece that was in the Washington Post. And the first paragraph, this is very naughty of the Post, puts forward this idea. It seemed like a fringe idea not too long ago, but the proposal for South Korea to have its own nuclear arms is gaining steam here. It's byline from Seoul. But the next sentence, starting the next para, is there are many reasons South Korea probably will not pursue this path. So I'm beginning to wonder, I have a feeling that this is, you know, the reason we talk about it, I mean, you've got Kim Jong-un, who's probably not as crazy as he's portrayed in
The Western media. Absolutely.
You've got Donald Trump, who's clearly as crazy as everybody portrays him. I mean, he's just unstable. Mm-hmm. That's clear from his behavior. Even when he has good days, he's still unstable. And you've got, and they're throwing this rhetoric at each other. And the thing is that there's no margin for error with nuclear weapons. Absolutely none. And if one side misreads the other, then you have a real terrible situation. My guess is that these polls in South Korea are media stimulating the society in which, so I mean, they just elected someone as president who actually wants some kind of dialogue and rapprochement with the North. That was a winning ticket quite recently. So now the idea that, we need our own nuclear deterrent, I think it is mostly an expression of a general fear. And I still think that the reality of the whole situation at the moment is the Chinese are having a very good time at the moment, and they need to sustain the growth they've got in their economy. And they can't have a war on the Korean Peninsula. And if it was really serious, what was going on between Kim Jong-un and the U.S., the Chinese would damp it all down because they can't afford to have any kind of major conflict on that peninsula.
But on that thought, at the risk of tempting fate, Somnath, the if it was really serious thing, it's what I keep thinking myself, that if it was really serious, we would start to see things like actual defensive measures and or panic in the streets of Seoul. We would see the United States evacuating tens of thousands of American nationals who live in South Korea. Has this all been somewhat flammed up by both the participants on either side and the media, which is frankly enjoying the whole thing enormously?
No, you're right about it, but I don't know what could be more serious than testing of nuclear weapons by slightly unstable dictators.
Well, you make a reasonable point. I'm not saying I'm not saying you could sort of relegate it to a small paragraph on page 10. But
having said it, the point being that testing a nuclear weapon is one thing, and making warheads and readily deployable warheads is completely another thing. That takes a much longer time. The fact that they might have the capacity to develop this is frightening. And one of the things, and I don't know, Michael, you might be able to say this better or know about this more, that I found a certain toning down of the U.S., Trump's blowing to smithereens in North Korea after the nuclear test. I didn't find such belligerent statements. I found more like going to UN and more sanctions and conversations around should he come to the table. So do you think that even the threat of North Korea being able to develop tones down the U.S. rhetoric?
No, I think that's the rhetoric has come down. You're right to mark it over the last month. And it's just something I noticed, and I think that's the John Kelly effect.
I was about to ask exactly that question. Yeah. I'm assuming that John Kelly has Trump's arm twisted behind him, possibly even literally.
People joke and say that he's got all five of his smartphones. apparently there was a guy who was actually writing some of those tweets for Trump. He had like a tweet, they're all gone. Mm. Right. And
nice work if you can get it. I mean, what are the hours?
Oh, God. Yeah. And think of where you have to visit him to actually get a sign off, because it's 4 a.m. Trump's 70 years old, and where 70-year-old men are. Anyway, well, keep it clean. No, I think that this is the Kelly effect. Nobody's written about it yet, but circumstances, the two hurricanes have calmed him down, given him a focus. But I also think Kelly is really running the show now.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, along with Michael Goldfarb and Somnath Batabile. Coming up next, one of the world's grimmer regimes wants to make friends.
Buckle up, put the armrest down, and slide away that table. The third edition of The Escapist, Monocle's annual travel-focused journal, has landed. Our editors and bureau chiefs offer you their take on those far-flung places where opportunity and great design find a home. We head to Semmering in Austria, a sleeping architectural beauty being gently awoken by an ambitious set of hospitality entrepreneurs. Then we take a drive down Turkey's liberal west coast and dust up on Broome's long history of welcoming new arrivals to Western Australia. Also, our culture editor, Rob Bound, sifts the treasure from the trash in Benidorm. We also reveal the winner of Monocle's third annual restaurant awards, as well as a crop of comfy new hotels in which to rest your head. The Escapist is your summer set piece, packed with the sunniest and smartest insights from leaders in the travel industry. The Escapist, on newsstands now.
Being a pop star seems like a dazzling, lavish lifestyle, right? But have you ever wondered how your favourite pop song was written?
I do a lot of writing in the bath with my housemate sat on the toilet taking a photo.
Or who that song was really intended for.
Writing love songs in Spanish, I could say really pathetic, sad things. And it would be a secret from the audience and also from the person that I was writing about.
Join us on The Sessions at Midori House each week, where we bring in a wealth of musical talent to perform live for us and reveal a few truths about making music and keeping your ego under control. Well, sometimes.
I'm unconsciously comparing myself like a jackass to Paul McCartney.
From electropop to indie rock and with plenty of soul to boot, tune into The Sessions at Midori House every Saturday at 8:15 London time for lessons in stardom and a soundtrack to kickstart your weekend.
Bye-bye. You're back with Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Michael Goldfarb and Somnath Batabayil. Now, leaving aside the moral quandaries occasioned by taking the job, it would certainly test the abilities of any PR executive. The Kingdom of Saudi Arabia intends to set up public relations hubs in Europe and Asia in order to push back against negative press coverage of Saudi Arabia. As is so very often the case, the option of just doing less of the stuff that attracts negative press coverage appears not to have occurred to anybody. Somnath, this sounds vaguely familiar. They're going to produce press releases, they're going to spam social media, they're going to invite influencers, whoever they are, to visit the kingdom. Is this the Russia playbook being run by the Saudis here?
It's a Vision 2030, which they have. I'm told that they want more tourists in. The Red Sea is becoming the part of a tourist hub.
By 2030, they hope to be up to at least 1630, presumably.
That's their long-term vision. Women's emancipation has come in a big way, and the Crown Prince apparently is very determined that women should be able to drive by 2030.
In a big way, again, is a relative
yes.
concept.
And you know, the male guardians need not be necessary or as much. So I don't know, you know, whether it'll work, because the press feedback from the UK, just the last couple of months, I was just looking at the article since afternoon when I started preparing, has been quite negative. You know, weapons, stories about women's emancipation. So depends on what their strategy is. Will it be state-backed? Is this a private enterprise, or will the state be funding it? So, but it's clear that if Saudi Arabia is to change their overview in the world, it needs serious public relations, yes. Otherwise, but as you said, changing their attitude might help, but that doesn't seem to be the focal point at all.
Now, Michael, if you do want to write negative stories about Saudi Arabia, it's not like there's a shortage of material to work with. If you were trying to present a positive image of the kingdom to the world, how would you go about it?
I won't reveal my trade secrets because I've dusted down my CV. I'm desperate for a regular job, and if they're willing to hire a nice Jewish boy from New York, I've actually been to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia,
which in itself is not an easy thing to do.
No. This is, I mean, so if you ask me, the first thing is I would ditch the Soviet era. I mean, it's probably not as bad as it was. I went more than a decade ago. In the wake of I was doing a lot of reporting after 9/11 and covering the Iraq War, and the one Arab country in the Middle East that I had not been to was the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, and it was like going to the old Soviet Union, which I had also done in terms of what the months of haggling and negotiation, and then the minder, instead of KGB, it was from the Ministry of Islamic Culture and Guidance, who didn't meet me at the airport. And I was on my own for almost 3 weeks, and I speak no Arabic. And I just, every day I'd remind myself, if someone asks you and finds out that you're a Jewish American wandering the back alleys of certain small towns in Saudi Arabia, investigating, you know, the mise-en-scene of the 9/11 hijackers, you're going straight to prison, and they're never going to hear from you again. What they need to do is something that clearly Crown Prince Salman is trying to modernize the country at the same time that he's also trying to put it on a more belligerent and aggressive international posture. And it's all doable, except that within the House of Saud itself, there's still this drag anchor of people who don't want any foreigners in. And it's going to be very difficult for them to change their image. It's not just about the relation, you know, the role of women in the society or anything else. This is so structurally deep into the society. It is truly, as it seems, it's a feudal society with this phenomenal wealth from oil that is dispersed by its royal family. And that's how the economy works more than anything. And I don't really know how they can modernize or create kind of positive publicity about a modern country with, you know, half, you know, say 30% of the next generation agrees with the Crown Prince and their bread is buttered by the Crown Prince. But in terms of convincing the rest of the world, I don't think so.
I mean, Somnath, Russia, in its PR outreach to the Western world, does have a certain sympathetic constituency it can reach out to, which is the sort of slightly cranky anti-American wing of the European left. Does Saudi Arabia have a likely sympathetic audience anywhere?
No.
This is going to be their problem, isn't it?
I can't think of any part of the West of Europe. Or the Western civilization, where Saudi Arabia will get a decent hearing. But I'll disagree a bit with Michael on the fact that it's not. It doesn't have to be open and invite tourists or foreigners in to be portrayed as a friendly country. I mean, if we take small mountain countries, I would say Tibet. It's not necessarily very friendly, but because it's not suppressing women necessarily, or Bhutan for that. I mean, I'm just talking about smaller kingdoms where foreigners might not be coming in, but the way of life. I mean, the feminist movement has happened in the 1960s. It's in Saudi Arabia. No one has seen light of day there. So I would disagree that the way you conduct your daily governance does matter.
Okay, well, let's look on that subject finally tonight at the Philippines, whose President Rodrigo Duterte has made a career-long point of his lack of interest in the due process of law and other such liberal fripperies. Nor has he ever extended much time to his political opponents. Now, Duterte's supporters in the Philippines Congress have acted on both those cues, voting by a hefty margin to reduce the annual budget of the Philippines Commission on Human Rights to 1,000 pesos, which is about $20. Now, that's not going to go far. It's a bit of a reduction from the $34 million they'd asked for. It's possibly a silly question. Why are they doing this?
A country which needs a PR machine is Philippines. they definitely. Why are they doing this? Because, again, a person at the helm does not want to hear one dissident voice. Absolutely not. But again, this goes. There's a larger perspective. The war on drugs was started by another country. There is a long history of how drugs, violence have been dealt with, and this man is on a one man mission to kind of change the way it happens in the country. But this just seems, as you say, it seems an outrage to all kind of any kind of rational human thought.
It's part of a bizarre global phenomenon, though, Michael. Human rights in a lot of places in the world becomes a term of abuse. It becomes a thing you sneer. How has that happened? I mean, they're a good thing, aren't they, basically? I mean, I'm a
once
human
again,
and I'm grateful for the ones I
once
have.
Once again, we go back to George W. Bush. this is all part of the terrible knock-on effect of the failure in Iraq. At one level, the cynics, a lot of the people who were on the platform at the London March in February 2003, this is American imperialism. But, that's too easy. There are a lot of people who thought, we have a new global order here. It's not a bipolar world. You have this really grotesque dictator who's just needs a push to go. And perhaps we can bring human rights into an area of the world where they've been conspicuous by their absence. And then, of course, it turned out to be a total failure. And now Russia can come out along and say, what is human rights? What is democracy? Look what democracy did in Iraq. Look at the failures here. Look at the failures there. And this is really a knock-on effect. And, in terms of the Philippines, there's not been a great tradition of human rights there for most of the last 50 or 60 years. I mean, don't forget the Marcos family business.
Well, indeed.
And speaking of human rights, one of the funniest lines that P.J. O'Rourke ever wrote, and P.J. O'Rourke is he's a conservative American, wrote for Rolling Stone, he was the House conservative, and he had been to the Philippines and he saw how awful human rights were under the Marcoses, who were supported by Ronald Reagan and so on. And when he fell, P.J. wrote, I'd like to see him nailed by the ears to the bumper of a car and driven through Manila. And I've always remembered that line. I think of that when I read about Duterte.
Well, on that happy thought, it concludes an episode of Midori House, which we've learnt that, strangely, almost everything is George W. Bush's fault. Somnath Battabile and Michael Goldfarb, thank you both very much for joining us. The show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Mariana Lagrasta. Our studio manager was David Stevens. Music next at 1900. Danny is in with the entrepreneurs. There's more on the day's main stories on the daily at 2200. I'm back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.